Welcome to Torah Smash, the podcast for nerdy Jews, where our lives of Jewish learning collide with our love of nerd culture. In each episode, we discuss what we lovingly call a Torah Smash, which we have defined as a beautiful collision of one thing from the world of Judaism with another from nerd culture. I am RDY, and joining me today are
Barack Malkin
and Josh Skye.
Unfortunately, Ethan needs to step away for a few episodes for personal reasons, but he's hoping to be recording with us again soon, and we cannot wait for him to come back. But our guest for today's episode is Josh Skye. Originally from Maui, Hawaii, growing up, Josh had a tropical Jewish upbringing. After graduating high school, he dropped everything to live with his uncle's family in New York and attended Brooklyn College. Josh is currently a writer for He-Man and the Masters of the Universe and Heavy Metal Illustrated. He has written for Marvel, Humanoids, Psy Futures, Tor.com, SFWA, Assemble Media, Tales Interactive, Sunman, Mattel, and Cartoon Network's Ben 10. Further, Josh has worked as a copywriter on film and theatrical campaigns such as Deadpool 2, The Predator, Birds of Prey, and Love, Death, and Robots. Welcome, Josh Skye.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I'm really excited to be here.
There is so much in your introduction that I like want to just break into, and I'm holding back so much. You have a very impressive background. That's very cool.
Thanks, and man. I actually just listening to it a lot, I'm like, I want to cut like a third of it because I'm like, that's a lot for someone to read. So thank you for enduring that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited now that the writers and actors strikes are both over as we record for Deadpool 3. So, you know, any insight you can give us on that, please don't. Before we get into the topic, I want to remind all of our listeners to mark your calendars and get ready. Because coming this January to Chicago is Torah Smash Live. Barack, Ethan, and myself are going to be in the same zip code together for the first time ever, and we will be recording a live episode, and we're inviting you all to join. Saturday, January 13th, 2024 at KAM Isaiah Israel in Chicago. For more details on this event, go to torahsmash.com/live. Come to nerd out with us, hear our amazing stories, and be a part of Jewish history. Take it away, Josh.
First off, again, guys, thanks so much for having me and for expressing interest and also for doing a podcast like this. I think it's really cool and needed out there in the media landscape. And also just to have a forum to discuss this because it's like kind of a niche, but I think also very interesting thing because it's so entwined into nerd culture, but really culture, honestly, because I do think that, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, comics and science fiction, that's nerd culture. I'm like, no, that's all culture. And it's extreme, a lot more influential than we all think. I see it every day. And what I really wanted to discuss was just kind of have a historical walkthrough with you guys on Jewish publishers and writers and artists who inadvertently, through the pulp magazines, launched modern comics and science fiction and just kind of changed a lot of the way we view the world today and also a lot of the way we view story, honestly. So I'm really excited to delve into that. And the first thing I wanted to talk about is that modern science fiction, I mean, arguably a lot of people talk about how it really started with like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But, you know, to me, it really starts with this guy named Hugo Gernsback, who is from Luxembourg, who was into radio technology and electricity. I mean, he came to the U.S. and in April 1926, he started the magazine Amazing Stories, which is the first pulp science fiction magazine solely focused on science fiction. I don't think science fiction was even a term.
No,
at that time.
Yeah, I know that Hugo Gernsback had coined that. He was the first one credited with using the term science fiction.
Yeah, for a second I thought it was actually someone else, but I realized it was the term sci-fi that was coined by someone else, which was Forrest J. Ackerman, who created the magazine Famous Monsters of Filmland and Vampirella. But Gernsback, I mean, at the time when he launched Amazing Stories, the term he called for those sorts of stories was scientification. They didn't even, the genre was so nascent at the time. What happened was he was doing all these radio technology magazines, and there was space in the magazines where he started printing stories. And he wanted these stories to showcase technology. right, to showcase these new inventions in use, because they didn't have video technology at the time yet. They didn't have, certainly not in a portable fashion like we do today. So they used stories, and some of them were reprints, but eventually started needing original stories. And he realized that there was kind of this interest that he also enjoyed, not only reading it, but writing it himself. And that's how these magazines started coming about. You know, initially, when Amazing Stories launched, a lot of it was reprints, but eventually they started sourcing stories from other places in the country and around the world. And eventually they just started commissioning new stories. And that's really what launched modern science fiction as we know it.
Do you know if any of those early stories in those issues that Hugo had put out, did any of them have any either subtle Jewish or overt Jewish connotations, any of them, as somebody branching into that new realm of literature or writing?
That's a really good question. Not that I know of off the top of my head. I know that a lot of the writers and artists and editors, and that Hugo Gernsback himself was Jewish. He was a Jew from Luxembourg. He also wore a monocle, which is like pretty hilarious, I think. And he was notoriously not the best to deal with for artists and writers also. They actually used to call him Hugo the Rat, which is terrible, but he kind of earned that reputation. But what was interesting was that he created multiple magazine lines. Not only that, the term Hugo Award is named after him, which is the highest accolade one can win in modern science fiction today, writing today.
Wow, cool.
The Academy Awards of Science Fiction.
Wow. Do you think the Hugo the Rat title had anti-Semitic undertones to it? Or is that
I think he stiffed a lot of creatives. I don't think it was so much that he was Jewish, because I think some of the writers that he had and artists that he had were Jewish and editors. I think that he was running publishing companies, and that some of these magazines could go under. And like a lot of people in publishing even today, they mean well, but sometimes they're in over their heads. And before they know it, they're in debt and they can't always pay the debt, or they're trying to escape it. Yeah. So I think that was part of it. I couldn't tell you if it had anti-Semitic undertones or not. I've not read anything to confirm or deny that.
That's cool. So if he launched science fiction, what were some of the initial like large properties that came out of this new pathway? Like how far after was Isaac Asimov?
Isaac Asimov really came around during the golden age of science fiction, which really was authored through another magazine called Astounding. Astounding magazine.
It sounds like a spoof of Amazing Stories.
Right. Well, they all kind of had like amazing and incredible. And you see these sorts of things in the lead titles of comic books, which would come later. But Astounding
Tales
started.
To Astonish.
Right. Tales to Astonish. Absolutely a pulp title. But Astounding Stories started in January 1930. And initially, these sorts of magazines were much more adventure oriented, you know, with science fiction elements, you know, or scientific elements. But with Astounding Stories came the editor and writer John W. Campbell, who I believe was not Jewish. And he was a writer in his own right. And he ended up writing the story Who Goes There, which would become known as The Thing. And he wrote that during the golden age of science fiction. What John W. Campbell did that changed the science fiction genre was, he basically made it a requisite that stories, if they didn't work with scientific elements, then he wouldn't accept them. He wouldn't buy them. Hmm. So that really changed everything. And science fiction for a long time, and even to a degree today, was really seen as kind of this marginalized genre that was in the ghetto along with fantasy and horror and comic books. But John W. Campbell is definitely instrumental in bringing about one of the most famous Jewish science fiction writers' careers, which was Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov was a kid in Brooklyn.
If you're Brooklyn, you're Jewish, even if you're not Jewish.
Pretty much, yeah. But the thing of it was, Isaac Asimov was always a really brilliant mind, and he loved science fiction as a kid. And his father owned a candy store in Brooklyn. And what he would do is he would read the magazines, and like his family was, you know, not well off. So these were products that they would need to sell. So his family didn't take a loss on, he would keep the magazines in pristine condition. I mean, these are pulp magazines, which if you touch them the wrong way, they'll turn to dust. But a part of like Asimov's upbringing that I think made him really brilliant, besides natural talent, like mental talent, the raw intelligence, was that his father and mother made it required that if he was to pick up a book on fiction, he had to also borrow a book on nonfiction. He also had like a photographic memory. He described himself as a speed explainer, not a speed writer.
I've read some Asimov and I don't think it was very speedy.
No, the way Asimov's career really got launched was a month had been skipped or issue had not been released the date it usually releases for Astounding Stories. And he got really scared because, like, now, back then, like, a lot of these sorts of magazines would get canceled and that would be the end of them, right? So he was so scared that he opened up one of the old back issues and saw the address for Smith and Street, and he actually had ridden the train into Manhattan for the first time. He had never left Brooklyn as a kid. And he showed up to the offices, and he asked to speak to the editor of Astounding.
Just like, where's my magazine?
Yeah, where's my magazine? I mean, can you imagine a Marvel fan doing that now?
It sounds like Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory. That sounds like something he would have done, is like, my magazine's not in. I got to go find out what's wrong. Like,
that's a good pull.
100%. He was one of the original OG nerds.
And if we're on him, he was also Jewish, right?
Very Jewish. Very much. Yeah. He was secular himself. His family was very much Jewish. He was of Jewish descent, of course, and there are a lot of Jewish themes in his writing, no doubt. And there were a number of contemporaries of his, and then later on in the new wave of writers who were of Jewish descent in science fiction. You know, you had guys like Harlan Ellison, Robert Silverberg.
Wait, before we jump off of Isaac, sure. You know, you said there's a lot of influence, Jewish influence in his. And as we're talking about it, the laws of robotics that he had created, I think he had created those three laws of robotics, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, he also coined the term robotics.
Oh, cool.
Did he create the term robot?
I don't believe he created the term
robot. Do I remember that that's an acronym?
No, I don't believe so. But I don't know, to be honest. But I know that Isaac Asimov
it's a Slavic word that means labor.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think
robots are slaves, but don't let them hear you say that.
Well, I think that these three laws have a very Jewish connotation, whereas you follow those first two laws. I'm trying to remember. One was follow. Can't hurt a human. Can't hurt a human.
Follows. No. Follows. A robot may not injure a human being or through an action allow a human being to come to harm.
Mm-hmm.
A robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Yeah.
And a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first and second law.
Yeah, right. In Jewish law, Rabbi, you can correct me if I have the language wrong, but in terms of mitzvot, right, saving a life is above everything else. And that's how these laws of robotics are working, that as long as you do not harm or kill a human, the other ones are fine. But that comes first, right? That is above all else. It sounds that's super Jewish. And I'm curious if he took that from the Talmud or if it was just subconsciously something that had come out of him.
I would imagine something subconscious. I'm not sure how religious he was in his own studies, but definitely he was steeped in Jewish culture, no doubt. He was definitely steeped in Jewish culture and in Yiddish culture, certainly. And he certainly had studied a lot of Jewish biblical texts.
I do have it on good authority. That authority is called Wikipedia. So Asimov wrote of his father, "My father, for all his education as an Orthodox Jew, was not Orthodox in his heart. He didn't recite the myriad prayers prescribed for every action, and he never made any attempt to teach them to me."
Mm. So the prayers, but maybe the practice. He's a cultural Jew.
Definitely did not do Vishinantam Levanecha, teach them diligently to your children.
Right.
Definitely culturally Jewish. I mean, I know this much. When World War II broke out, by then Isaac Asimov had gotten a lot of stories published and was known in the science fiction community. And to protect him, you know, Robert A. Heinlein was in the military, and so was L. Sprague de Camp. And they helped him get a gig when he was in the military on a base, because he certainly wouldn't have done well in combat, and he would have been the first to admit it. I mean, he was afraid. He was definitely afraid of flying.
And his sideburns could have caught fire.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, absolutely.
I'm sad that we hadn't mentioned his epic sideburns until just now.
If you ever see a picture of Isaac Asimov, his mutton chops are utterly insane. On that base, though, the base didn't want to give Jews in the military Yom Kippur off for those who wanted to observe it. So some military Jews had gone around asking other Jews to sign this petition, and Asimov had signed it in support, even though he himself wasn't really religious. But going back to what we were saying, what was so important about Amazing Stories was other magazines would come after it, like Astounding, like Galaxy. Astounding would turn into Analog Fantasy and Science Fiction. I mean, all that really stemmed originally from Amazing Stories. And to this day, it's still where usually the most cutting edge science fiction does come out of the literary short story. However, also from the science fiction pulps came comic books. Originally, Marvel Comics, the banner Marvel was first used on a pulp science fiction magazine, not a comic book.
Right. Same with Superman.
Right. Superman, interestingly enough, oh my gosh. So at Jewish Comic Experience, Miriam Mora, who curated the whole thing, had mentioned to me, I got to attend, it was really wonderful, and I hope they do it again.
But Miriam Mora did.
By the way, we have the original science fiction fan magazines done by Siegel and Schuster. And
that was so cool. To have it right there in their original drawings was incredible.
All right, guys. I already have FOMO. Come on.
Right. It's all right. Well, Siegel and Schuster were two teenage boys who live in Cleveland. They're very Jewish, and they were science fiction fans. And the way science fiction fans found each other back in the day was they would write letters to these magazines, and their addresses would be printed, and then they'd start corresponding with each other. You know, it was almost like a Jew finding another Jew in the desert for these fans. And Siegel and Schuster realized that they lived something like 12 blocks from each other, but they lived close enough where they could meet each other, and they both followed these magazines. I mean, back then, those magazines were kind of the streamers of their day for what genre you're into, right? There was radio, television wasn't really a technology yet, but these two teenagers met each other and they started developing their own science fiction magazines. A lot of it, unfortunately, was because Jerry Siegel, though he could write, it was really hard, and it's very hard now to break into the magazines, and they don't pay particularly well if you sell a story. So Jerry Siegel and Schuster started doing their own fan magazines, and the only 50 copies were printed of these high school magazines, but in there was the first Superman story, which was Reign of the Superman, which was, if you look at it, it's kind of hilarious because Superman's bald and a mad scientist, very different idea of what he is today. I mean, it's more Lex Luthor-ish of what you would think of Lex Luthor than Superman. But yeah, it was absolutely influenced by those magazines. So you could start seeing, even from there, they did these science fiction magazines with the first appearance of the superhero that would become Superman. But also in these science fiction magazines, that's how Buck Rogers, and Tarzan, and Conan, and The Shadow. The more I read about The Shadow, the more you realize Batman is an absolute ripoff of The Shadow. You know,
I thought Batman was a ripoff of Deflator Mouse from The Tick.
For sure.
Tick didn't come first, did it?
No.
Okay.
Deflator Mouse was a rip on Batman.
Oh, okay.
Well, I used to work at Marvel, and I remember reading a list of Jewish superheroes, and I went, oh my gosh, the Tick is Jewish. I didn't know that. And then my friend said, really? I said, oh, wait, never mind. It's Arthur.
Yeah, Arthur.
I mean, which is cool, but it would have been cooler if it was the Tick.
Can I ask, you've worked on a bunch of more modern science fiction-y type things, and I'm curious if you've ever subtly put in background or side characters that you deem to be Jewish that like maybe never took off. Do you, in your writings in these different areas, slip in Jewish characters to get some more representation or some Jewish content or anything like that? Or are they sort of like major levels of approval? And
I think there's definitely like Jewish ethics in there, no doubt, you know, and certain lessons. Like one of the best lessons I ever learned was about jealousy. I remember when I was in Hawaii, like growing up, I'd go to school and then I'd go to Hebrew day school afterwards. And I remember I must have been like 11 or 12. My Hebrew teacher, she was Israeli. She said, if something good happens to someone, you should never be jealous. You should always be happy for them. And it's such a simple lesson, but I think that's one of the most valuable lessons a kid can learn, honestly. Especially if you're working in entertainment, because there are a lot of haters, right? Like, and people get really jealous or dog on themselves.
I wonder what age that disappears, because my older son is 5 and he's in kindergarten, and they have this sticker award sheet that they utilize. And when you get to 10 stickers, you get a gift from the gift box. And he has not progressed as quickly through these sticker sheets as other classmates have. He's only done one full sheet and he's got a few on the second sheet right now. And other people have already gotten to their third and he is so excited for them. He's not upset that he's not there. He's what you're talking about. He's just happy that the other people have gotten 3 full sticker sheets and have gotten 3 toys from the toy bin, but he's not, and I've only gotten 1. I wish I had 3. He's never come out of his mouth. He's always like, yeah. And some people, they've gotten 3 so far. It's just, I don't know when that's going to disappear. And it makes me so sad that there's some innate thing that is built in of just pure joy for others. And somewhere along the lines, jealousy kicks in as a way to take over that subconscious?
I don't think it has to. I think that you could train yourself to always be joyful for people.
Yeah, I hope so.
I'd like to believe that I feel joy naturally when people, you know, have that. And I hope that if I ever feel any of those inclinations, that I'll fight them and just say, no, I am happy. I choose to be happy for someone over that. But yeah, I've written about that in a forthcoming comic book that I can't talk about. But but it's about that. It's about that lesson.
Can you tell us the distributor so we can keep an eye out for you?
No. I guess, okay. I can talk about it. I mean, by the time it comes out. But basically, I wrote about that in a He-Man story.
Oh, so sweet.
In a forthcoming He-Man story.
Can I ask some other He-Man question?
Sure, yeah.
Are you involved in the movie at all?
I am not. I feel like it's so funny. You know, I worked at Marvel licensing. And when you go, oh, you worked at Marvel, like, people think, what is it, Spider-Man's jumping around? These companies are so big, I feel, for the most part, that one hand sometimes doesn't know what the other hand is doing. And that's not to comment on any of these companies. But what I mean by that is so massive and the divisions are so in their own lane. The movie lane and the comic people, even in my lane, like in the mini comics. So no, I'm not involved in the movies. I'm really excited for what they're cooking up over there. I don't know what they're making, honestly. I don't have any insight into it, but I am excited. I know that much.
I'm excited that Kevin Smith is involved. I feel like he has such a love for the source material that he'll really give it the treatment it deserves. And I hope he reads your stuff.
Oh, thanks. And yeah, I've met him before. He's a really nice guy.
Oh, I bet. A little insight into the RDY backstory is that I worked at a short-lived restaurant called Marvel Mania. The restaurant lasted about 2.5 years, and I was there the day it opened, and I was there the day it closed. And there were Spider-Mans jumping around all over the place, so that's probably why I got
there. Wow, it seems much more action-packed than the Marvel offices in New York City. much less corporate, I would imagine. Yeah. No, I worked in licensing, and it was like, in licensing at Marvel, you were licensing, and the comic team was working on the comics, and the studio is working on the studio, and they, you know, they're the same company, but they may as well have been different ones, you know, even though they're different divisions, because you were so laser focused on what you were working on that's what you were working on, you know, and helping with those parts of the business that you were involved with. But I guess going back to what we were saying before, like, really what this all ties into is you had all these different Jewish creators that were involved in the development of characters like Batman and Superman and Captain America. You know, comics were born from the pulps. You know, Marvel science fiction eventually gave way to Marvel comics. And before DC was DC, they were a pulp publisher and also published like lurid magazines and stuff like that. And eventually Detective Comics would be born from that. And from those magazines, you had all these characters like X-Men and the Avengers and Human Torch and on and on and on. Why does this matter? Well, inadvertently, a lot of these characters would have Jewish ethics involved because they had Jewish creators and artists. Many of them, including the editors and even the owners of the company, happen to be Jewish. And all these creatives and all these people had inadvertently created a neo-mythology. Before, mythology was tied to religion and culture. And because these companies were in America and they're businesses and they had business interest in making them universal, so this new mythology had been born that was no longer connected to religion, but still connected with ethics. And a lot of those ethics happened to be Jewish. So I thought that was very, very interesting. And now you could have someone from any part of the world follow these stories and learn from them and get life-affirming lessons. And of course, hopefully buy an action figure and a t-shirt. But it doesn't have to be tied to, it could tie to who they are, but not necessarily like cultural upbringing, you know, that anybody could connect with it and identify with it. I think that's really unique.
Yeah, I agree that a lot of content today has Jewish ethics and the undertones. And part of me wishes it was a little more overt and upfront of where it's coming from, because a lot of Jewish ethics are just be a good person and treat others well and treat the earth well and treat your neighbor well and behave in whatever that might mean in the broad sense. And it's for good people. And so it'd be nice if when people are reading that, they go, oh, that's Jews are wonderful people. And because, you know, Superman's not canonically Jewish, Batman's not canonically Jewish, Spider-Man's not canonically Jewish. There's a lot of undertones in their stories that tie to Jewish culture and ethics that even though people love those characters, may not have a positive reaction to Judaism, and even the most popular characters of today have to hide their Judaism, right, in a sense. And that, you know, we do have Jewish superheroes today, which is wonderful, very small number of them. But I wish that they didn't have to, or I wish that it was a little more okay, especially with what's going on.
I hear what you're saying. I definitely hear what you're saying. The thing of it is, though, I think the creatives saw that to make them more universal, if for anyone to connect with them, it might have been better to not connect the heroes with any specific culture outside of American culture and any specific religion, right? Because if you read something, you're like, oh, it's this is this. You're like, well, you immediately go, well, I'm not bad. And how do I feel about that? You know what I mean? If you're American, then that's everything. And that includes Judaism. That also includes everything else in there, right? So I feel like on one hand, I see what you're saying. But on the other hand, I think that I wonder if it does it take away from its universality, you know?
Right. I do want to actually you a little bit and acknowledge that I know just a little bit. Because it's not a full-on, like, pushing my glasses up, actually. But I do want to acknowledge the people of color and the women in our country who have largely been underrepresented, especially in the early iterations of these stories.
For sure. Yeah. If you open up any of those original comics, yeah, there are virtually no people who aren't white, essentially, or waspy-looking. And that includes not a lot of people really even look Jewish, even though there are Jewish creatives behind it. You know, I think they wanted it to be like the movies, and the way the movies were doing it were what Hollywood believed people wanted to see at the time, you know? But I do think that we're seeing more and more representation now in these sorts of characters. There are characters like Miles Morales, you know, is written by a Jewish guy, but Miles is half Puerto Rican and half black. Yeah. Of course, Moon Knight, he's Jewish.
Miles Morales from Brooklyn? And we've already discussed that Brooklyn, that's if you're from true. Brooklyn, that you're automatically
that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, good point. Good point.
And also true. Kamala Khan as a Muslim and a woman and a person of color. Also, all of the LGBTQ characters who are coming out in our comic books.
Mm-hmm. No, 100%.
You know what I like in this is that while there is new representation, I like the idea that all of these stories, when we stem back to what you, Josh, have been talking about, they stem from this Jewish content or Jewish ethics, and that all of these stories of love and strength, if they're coming from Judaism, then we can say that all of these new superhero stories are because of this Jewish love for others and the idea that any of the ones they look at today, this is a big stretch. And I know it's not.
I think maybe for the creatives, not for the businessmen.
Absolutely. Agreed. Totally agreed.
There's a Jewish concept that we cover the challah on Shabbat before we light the candles and say the blessing over the wine. And that concept is because we don't want the challah to get jealous for being last. And one would think that a people who cares so much about the feelings of a loaf of bread would care so much for their fellow person. Mm-hmm. Right. But alas.
No. I think that those original creatives were more concerned about getting the right ethics and lessons and life-affirming thoughts and feelings into those stories and emotions. I feel like they're more interested in getting Jewish ethics in than saying that it is from Judaism, than calling it out. I think that they felt it was more powerful to do it that way, and especially in the climate of the time. I mean, remember, during the Golden Age, anti-Semitism was through the roof, right? Yeah. And the country could have turned. It really could have turned in a really negative way. You had Nazi rally marches in the middle of Manhattan. Madison Square Garden had a rally for Nazis as well.
I live in Skokie now.
Right. And then there was the American-German Bund that was very active in the U.S. just prior to World War II. So the country really could have turned. And that's why you see why are a lot of superheroes have anti-racist ideals. Why was that put into them early on in issues of Superman and Captain America and such? Why is it heroic to be anti-racist? Well, it's because they were dealing with anti-Semitism at the time. I mean, a lot of that's where that stems from. Right.
That's cool. Whenever talking about comic books, most of my conversations always go back to Superman as the origin of all of these stories. And it's really cool to think about that's actually not the start. It's Hugo. It's Isaac Asimov. Those were the ones who started the story for Siegel, for Schuster, for Kane. That's where it started, was back in the science fiction magazines, which is very cool.
Yeah, it would start. I would say it would start with the pulps, and from the pulps were born the science fiction pulps, and from the science fiction pulps came comic books. And you had publishers like Hugo Gernsback and Martin Goodman, who oversaw Marvel, and Leibowitz, who oversaw DC, and from all these different magazine and comic book lines sprang all these stories and this evolving mythology. And I think that's what really was brought to the table by these guys. The mythology wasn't locked. It was open. It was open source. And because it was open source, it could evolve and change. And that was really the contribution that they did or made.
Yeah, very cool. Is there anything you want to like wrap up this and close this circle with, or close these gears on this robot?
Like the lesson of the day?
Yeah.
The lesson for the day to me is that these stories are for everyone to learn from and be entertained by, and they're constantly changing. And I think that's the best way to do them. And yes, they do have a lot of Jewish roots, but more importantly, like they're universal.
If I may offer a smash.
Yeah.
You know, the Torah itself was, in a sense, the science fiction of its time, because it was the work that offered innovations in worship, innovations in peoplehood, innovations in things that they wanted to see happen in the future. Feminism, it could be argued, got its start in the Daughters of Tzelofechad, who had the audacity to ask for land rights when there were no male heirs. So these kind of things, though it wasn't, you know, robots and spaceships, it was angels and demons and miracles. It was the amazing stories of the day.
Very fun.
No, that was super fun. That was great. No, 100%. The Torah is absolutely like high fantasy science fiction. If no one knew about religion and they read the Torah, I mean, it's so epic. It is so grand and stuff. And it makes sense that a lot of superheroes would be based on biblical characters, because those characters in their own right were supernatural, right? Were incredibly powerful. I just think that what a lot of these Jewish creatives did was basically bring a lot of these tenets from Jewish mythos and made them universal and open source so that they could continue on in their own way, you know? Yeah.
Nice. Awesome. Well, again, it's wonderful that you were able to join us. It was really great to be able to meet you at JUICE, the Jewish Comics Experience. I think we're all hoping that's happening again. Is there anything that you want to shout out or plug in the meantime?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys. Definitely check me out on Instagram at Joshua Sky Writer. I currently have a book of comic shorts out called Other Worlds for anyone who likes heavy metal type science fiction or stuff done in the vein of Love, Death, and Robots. It was illustrated by Gideon Kendall, who's an Eisner Award winning artist who also happens to be Jewish. And I have a bunch of He-Man stuff coming out through Mattel, through their He-Man Origins line or Master of the Universe Origins toy line. So definitely check that stuff out. And one of the most exciting things I'm working on is a graphic novel that I'm co-writing with the writer Ed Neumeier, who adapted Starship Troopers for the big screen, one of my favorite movies, co-wrote RoboCop. So it's really a dream to work with him.
Oh, that's really cool. I wish I picked up the one that was like Love, Death, and Robots, and I didn't realize that. But I picked up Golem, which is about the IDF using giant mecha robots, which they call golems, in the Middle East. So it was a pretty awesome. Cool read. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for checking out, man. And thanks for the plug. I really appreciate you guys. And thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. And before thank we go, I do. What'd you say, Artie? Anyway?
I said, thank you so much for being here. This was great.
Yeah.
Sure.
And before we go, this episode is coming out just before Hanukkah. So I think we should wish all of our listeners a very happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. Remember happy to take Hanukkah, guys. Your coat.
Remember to tip your what?
Remember to take down your Sukkot.
Yeah. so very cool. So,
oh, wait, one last thing I wanted to mention. Sorry. This is really insane, but there's so many stories we're missing out. I feel bad. But I spoke to the original writer of He-Man who wrote the original story Bible. His name is Michael Halperin. He's Jewish. And he told me something so insane I needed to record it. So I have it on record. But he said that He-Man was originally based on the story of the Maccabees. So you've got this like Aryan warrior with blonde hair, blue eyes, iron cross strapped to his chest. And he's based, you know, the original story that he had in mind was based on the story of the Maccabees. I thought that was so cool.
What a perfect tie-in for a Hanukkah episode.
No.
Oh, that's amazing. That's so cool. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. Yeah.
That's a very cool smash.
That's its own episode right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So hope your holidays are bright and filled with love and laughter and robots. But that'll do it for this episode of Torah Smash. Our fiscal sponsor is Jewish Creativity International. Our theme music was created by Sean Fogel. You can check out Sean's bands and studio work at www.thesleepywest.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to rate and review us wherever you listen. It helps others find us and is an excellent way to support the podcast. We want to hear from you and continue today's nerdy discussion. Go to torahsmash.com to find where to connect with us online, purchase swag from our store, support us with a donation, find previous episodes, and more. And in honor of Joshua's connection to He-Man, by the power of gray skull caps.
I definitely had Nomo, nerds of missing out. That was so emphatic.
That was so fun, RDY.
That was fun.